Boss level is the status a person or an organization achieves by making a better quality of life for themselves and others by doing what they need to do regardless of all the haters and obstacles out there. You're listening to the Boss Level Podcast, which is about people and organizations aiming for the boss level. Today's guest is Dave Snowden. And just to clear up a potential misunderstanding right away, Dave is not the NSA whistleblower with the same last name. He's called Edward Snowden. And it would be awesome to get Ed on the podcast, but I don't think he'll be visiting Helsinki anytime soon. But so, back to Dave. I first learned about Dave Snowden's work roughly 5 years ago at a conference. He was presenting Kinevan. Kinevan is a decision support framework that's based on complexity theory and cognitive science. And I'll admit it, it has taken me years to wrap my head around it. So be prepared. This is probably not the most easily digestible episode of Boss Level. When listening to the interview, I realized I often said yeah or uh-huh in response to something Dave said. And normally that would imply that I understood what was being said. However, in this interview, that is often not the case. But in addition to the brain-racking stuff, you can also find interesting thoughts on strategy, budgeting, performance targets, and other important management concepts. You'll also learn which is more accurate in predicting human behavior, the widely used Myers-Briggs personality types or astrology. Before we get into the interview, I would actually suggest that you take a look at the illustration of Kinevan, which shows the five domains we discuss. It'll be easier to follow the discussion once you've seen it. It's the first link in the show notes. Now, let's get to the interview. See you on the other side.
Okay, I'm Dave Snowden. I really have two manifestations at the moment, one of which is just forming. So coming up to 12 years ago now, I left IBM and created a company called Cognitive Edge. The idea being to take the principles of complexity theory and apply them in practice. Yeah? And we initially did that with risk assessment, horizon scanning for the Singapore government. We did DARPA work. And then we started to move into the development sector and then into industry generally. And really, since I did an XP conference in London about 6-7 years ago, Agile has become a large part of our work.
Okay.
It kind of like seemed to appeal to the XP guys, yeah? And then we moved on from that. I'm just setting up a new center for applied complexity at Bangor University in Wales.
Yep.
And that's going to focus more on the government development sector together with public good projects. So that's going to be like the R&D wing. And Cognitive Edge will carry on with the commercial side. So I'm now a visiting chair at Bangor University. And really, we'll start to run collaborative projects around things like project management, user requirements capture, Children of the World, which is a huge project to get citizens more interacting with government, a sort of beyond social media project, which we can talk about later.
Yep.
So really, there the projects are more research grant membership-based, not commercial contracts,
yes.
And that gives us more freedom.
Okay, and I think behind most of this work, or a lot of this work, is the Kinevan framework can you talk a little about that, briefly explain what it is?
It's a framework. It's a decision support framework which comes from a mixture of complexity theory and cognitive science. It didn't originate in complexity, interestingly. It started off in knowledge management.
I've
met the NARCA twice in my life now, once with the Agile Lean community and once with the knowledge management community. And I think both times I've been opposed to what he says, even though I like the guy.
So
knowledge management, you know, really hit in 95. And it really focused on codification of knowledge. That was the NARCA SECI model, right? So take tacit knowledge, write it down, put it into databases, and then the idea is you read the database and you can understand it. So the original Kinevan framework, and there's an article, Complex Acts of Knowing, which is on our website, which is now the third most cited paper in knowledge management. So I'm quite proud of that one. Which basically said you can't codify a large amount of what it is that human beings know. So informal networks, informal community, oral communication is a key part of human knowledge. What can be written down? I mean, the statement I adapted from Polanyi, we always know more than we can say. We will always say more than we can write down.
Mm-hmm.
So anything which focuses on text is a very limited representation of what human beings are capable of learning. Yeah? So even then, we were starting to challenge data analytics. And I'd also done a lot of work in artificial intelligence.
And when was this?
This is in the 80s, early 90s. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I was working with Prolog, for example. And yeah, I know I should have used Smalltalk, but it's the same principle, right?
Yeah.
To actually see, could we write systems which would replace doctors?
Yeah.
So this is the knowledge management decision support period. And kind of like there were, you know, after about 2 years of that, I realized that we couldn't. Yeah. Other people just said we didn't have better algorithms, but a whole group of us said actually human beings are different. And that's what took me down a different route, and everything comes from that. And then gradually I started to encounter complexity theory, and then Kinevin morphed into a complexity model which it now dominates.
Okay. And if you want to be concrete, so what does Kinevin help us with?
It basically says the nature of the system determines how you should act in it. Mm-hmm. So if you have a highly constrained system in which you can sustain rigid rules, which are called fixed constraints, you can apply best practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that only relates in highly stable, and generally in human beings, highly ritualized environments like operating theaters or pilots on aircraft, where you've got a repeatable, continuous process where you want to do the same thing continuously.
Yeah.
You then have complicated order,
which
has what are called governing constraints, which says, within a certain constraint framework, we got predictability. Yeah, so both the order domains, both obvious and complicated, have repeating relationships between cause and effect. The same thing will happen again the same way twice. The difference is in obvious, everybody can see what it is, whereas in complicated, you have to do analysis to find it.
Okay, yes.
So in complicated, you have good practice. In obvious, you have best practice. And that's a really important distinction. Yeah, there's variation.
Yeah.
Then you get the complex domain. Now, a complex adaptive system is one in which there is no repetition. So the brutal statement on this, which is difficult for people to grasp, is it isn't causal, it's dispositional.
Yeah.
So I can measure, I can make statements about the present, but I can't make statements about the future. So it has what are called enabling constraints. So the difference between governing and enabling is rather like an endo or an exoskeleton. An external skeleton contains everything.
Yeah.
An internal skeleton creates coherence, but it allows a larger degree of variation.
Yeah.
The difference between rules and heuristics is another illustration.
Mm-hmm.
So a complex world you can only understand by interacting with it. So you move into small, parallel, safe-to-fail experiments to see what can happen. And the things which work, you amplify. The things which don't work, you dampen. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different space. Yeah? And then the chaotic domain, and a lot of people in Agile get this wrong. They think chaos is a permanent state. Chaos is a domain of no constraints.
Yeah.
So if it happens accidentally, it's a disaster, but it will never survive for long.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can create it artificially, it's useful for all sorts of things like innovation and wisdom of the crowds. But it takes a lot of energy to maintain chaos. And the other thing people always forget about Kinevin, it's a five-domain model. So it's got the central domain of disorder, which is a state of not knowing which of the other domains you're in, which is kind of like a bad state.
Yeah.
So what it allows you to do is say, it's complex, we'll probe. It's complicated, we'll analyze.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite of a one-size-fits-all model.
Yeah.
So in software development, for example, if it's obvious, you can use waterfall methods. There's nothing wrong with them. Right.
Mm-hmm.
If it's complicated, you can use time boxes, and you can use big time boxes with lots of resources. If you're trying to move things from complex to complicated, then you use things like Scrum, sprints, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Complex domain, then we call pre-Scrum processes in Agile, which we can talk about later.
Yeah.
So different things for different domains based on different concept of causality and constraint. And that's what Kinevin is about.
Okay, so the idea is that when you know which domain you're in, then you know how to act within that domain.
Yeah, and also if you know where you're trying to move.
Yeah.
So we say you classify in Kinevin by domain and dynamic.
Okay.
So it's not just which domain I'm in, but am I trying to move between domains? So So, for example, moving from complex to complicated is good news because if you can increase the constraint to create predictability, then you can exploit faster. On the other hand, if you increase the constraints and they don't create predictability, then you shouldn't make the move. You should pull it back into complex again. Right? So the dynamic shifts between domains are as important as the domains themselves.
Okay, sure. And then how do you identify the domain that you are in?
Well, the way we create Kinevin, and it's interesting, Liz Keogh has done some good podcasts on this, right? Mm-hmm. She got it when I explained it to her. We define the domains and we define the boundaries by narratives from the organization's own history. So although you've got some general heuristics, like if the evidence supports competing hypotheses, assume it's complex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If the evidence allows you to decide what the right action is, assume it's complicated or fixed. But generally, we define the domains and the boundaries by stories from the organization's own history.
Okay.
Yeah. Or in some cases, by pure, I mean, Singapore government, we've done it with films because it's not even direct. So the idea is it's like these things, we agreed they were complex, we'll probe.
Yeah.
And it's much easier for people to match narrative than it is to actually deal with abstract concepts.
So you have a couple of stories that are kind of like examples of a complicated domain.
We'd normally have a cluster of about 15 or 16.
Okay, several
stories.
We'd
never go for one.
Yeah.
And the way we do it is called 4 points. So you basically, you create a data set of 200 or 300 stories and people position them relative to each other. Then you draw the Kinevin boundaries between the stories. So the data comes before the framework. And that's a sense-making framework works like that.
Yeah.
A categorization framework, the framework comes before the data.
Yeah.
And that produces a very different psychology.
Okay. And so how does the, like, once you know that, okay, I'm in the obvious domain or I'm the in the complicated domain, can you talk about, like, the differences in the way that you actually act within those different domains?
So if you're in the obvious domain, you establish best practice.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the example I normally give is, you know, in civilized countries, we drive on the left-hand side of the road.
Yeah.
So if we're in a civilized country, and you drive on the right-hand side of the road, expect the consequences. Sorry, I'm enjoying myself on this. And I remember back in 1969, Sweden decided to become uncivilized one weekend, all right? And they all went to driving on the other side of the road, right? In Southern Italy, it doesn't matter what the hell side of the road you drive on, provided you drive with confidence. So the principle is we've all bought into driving on the left. Therefore, it just makes sense in Britain to drive on the left. Like in Finland, you drive on the right, right? So that's kind of like a convention, but we've got to choose one option, we do it.
Yeah.
Right? So that's best practice.
Yeah.
There's also things like checklists. So if we want absolute repeatability, we can create control. The trouble is checklists only appear to work in highly ritualized environments.
Yeah.
Yeah, like operating theaters and the like. So kind of like that's cool, but generally, if you look at one of the Kinevin dynamics, you don't move things into the obvious unless you're absolutely sure you won't need to change them in the foreseeable future.
Okay, yeah.
But it's kind of like it's pretty rigid. And the danger is if you operate in that space when you shouldn't, then you create these very artificial rule constructs and people have to game the rules. They have to pretend to follow the process.
Yeah.
But in reality, they're doing something different. And I learned a lot of that in IBM. Yeah, kind of like you find ways around the rules, which meant the system appeared to be efficient, but actually it was extremely inefficient. Right?
Yeah.
And in Kinevin, obvious is next to chaos, because if you use it wrongly, you fall over the cliff into chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you build up tension in the system. Right? Mm. So obvious is rare, but if you can do it, it's very valuable.
Yeah.
Complicated is more common.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a rule construct with some variation in within the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the some variation is key, and I focus on building the right expertise and building training capability. So if people have the right training and the right experience, it's a combination of both, then within the constraints, they can vary what they do.
Yeah.
Which is why things like, you know, DSDM time boxes are good examples of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got a reasonable definition of the output, so we vary the time or the resources or the delivery. Yeah, we don't vary time, we vary delivery or resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a classic complicated approach.
Yeah.
Complex, you can't actually define where you should go. So in a complex space, we call them dispositional maps.
Mm-hmm.
You map the dispositions of the system to identify in what ways it's likely to evolve and what way it isn't. And you look for things, it's called the adjacent possible. So if you're in a bad space and you want to move to a good space, and the good space is a long way away,
yeah,
that's too far.
Yeah? Yeah.
So you find somewhere closer that you could move to, and then you shift into that space. Yeah. So, for example, and I mentioned this earlier, a sprint in Agile is a linear iterative process based on partial definition. So it's a complex to complicated boundary movement. That's its strength as a method. Yeah, but it's linear iterative.
Yeah.
Right? In the complex domain, and this is where we're doing new work on user requirements, if you get a cluster of coherent user stories about frustration, you might allocate a pair programming team for 3 days to build something to see if it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, if it works, would feed into a sprint. But you do lots of those in parallel.
Yeah.
Because you can't afford even the structure of a sprint. That's too structured for a truly complex domain. Yeah, so that's kind of like how you manage complexity.
Yeah.
The work we're doing with safety is to measure attitudes to safety.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing the same on software testing. Mm-hmm. Because attitudes are a lead indicator, compliance is a lag indicator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So by measuring attitudes and changing attitude and dispositions, you can get there. Right?
Yeah.
Chaos domain, well, if you fall into it accidentally, you have to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you do that by creating constraints, not by creating solutions, because that gives you more flexibility. But if you can deliberately create a space where nothing is connected with anything else,
mm-hmm.
then it's very powerful for innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also using it now for sophisticated real-time decision support.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, presenting a situation to 2,000 unconnected people, which they assess in real time and looking at the maps created from multiple individual assessments to provide real-time decision support. So all the domains work in different ways.
And the way that I've been thinking about this is, and you can tell me if I've gotten it correctly or not, but that a lot of the like traditional like management practices that companies use, they are like rooted in the complicated domain, but actually then the companies often they've actually a lot of their work or the things that they do have actually moved to the complex domain.
Or they never left it.
Yes.
Or even worse, if they've had the management consultants in, they've shifted things to obvious.
I mean,
they put in Six Sigma.
Yeah.
Or what we fondly call Six Stigma. Right. Yes. They put in over rigid control mechanisms.
Yeah.
Right. And yes, that's true. All right. Most, yeah. I mean, it's also interesting. What you get is this very strong manufacturing metaphor.
Yeah.
And this is a big problem in the Agile community. They keep using manufacturing metaphors. They assume they're producing a product.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas actually, software these days is a service relationship. So service is an open system, manufacturing is a closed system.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the trouble is the complicated and obvious methods work for closed systems,
mm-hmm.
but they don't work for open systems.
Yeah, yeah. So how should the insights from complexity theory and from Kinevan change the way that we run companies?
Well, they should radically reduce cost.
Yeah.
Because in a complex system, you manage the present.
Yeah.
And you ask three simple questions. You know, what can I change?
Yeah.
Out of the things that I can change, where can I monitor the impact of the change?
Yeah.
And where I could monitor the impact, where can I amplify success or dampen failure?
Yeah.
So life becomes a lot simpler.
Yeah. But that's not how you traditionally do it, because like the idea is that you should have a strategy, you should have a vision.
Actually, it is how you traditionally do it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I work with Peter Drucker on leadership quite a lot, right?
Yeah.
And this is how they did it in the scientific management days. I mean,
you
get some really naive people who've seized on complexity as justifying people doing what the hell they want without constraints, all right? Yeah. The reality is most of us in complexity argue for constraints, but we also argue for human judgment.
Yeah.
And if you go back to scientific management, they didn't have 3-year plans, 5-year plans, corporate objectives.
Yeah.
People just managed the present.
Yeah.
Yeah, they occasionally produced investment plans, but there was a huge emphasis on human judgment. So it's a 3 or 4 decade old, slightly deviant practice to assume you've always got to have a plan, right?
Yeah.
Now, I've yet to find anybody who can show me how a 3-year plan ever produced a good result, right?
Yeah.
And I always find it ironic that, you know, American capitalist companies adopt Soviet state planning techniques.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
It's not going to work, right? The fact that everybody says you should and they can't produce an example of where it's worked actually indicates maybe you should think differently.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, as you work into increasing levels of uncertainty, managing the present is a more successful survival strategy than trying to manage to some idealized future state you can't get to.
The next thing that we could go into is that I have a list of management concepts that I know that you have an opinion on. And I was just thinking that I'll just read one, one by one, and you can tell me what you think of them. So what do you think about company values?
101 anthropology. The minute you write your values down, you just lost them.
Yeah.
Because all you've done is teach people the language you want to hear back. So the minute you have new company values, people will use find and replace to change one set of language with another set of language on any business proposal, right?
Yeah.
I mean, anthropologists make a key difference between an ideation culture and a rule-based culture.
Yeah.
An ideation culture is the way we do things around here that we all understand, but we can't explain until you work with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, we map those cultures through water cooler stories. And we don't try and articulate values, but we say, how can we create more stories like this and fewer stories like that?
Yeah.
Not how can we create an abstract value?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, and the other problem is people try and align values, which is a mistake. I remember having this argument with Senge when he was prepared to talk with people, right? And these days he's in the guru mood, right? And basically the whole point is, I mean, the good news is you can't align everybody's values.
Yeah.
Because if you ever did, it would be a total disaster because the organization wouldn't now have requisite variety.
Mm-hmm.
It would lose its capacity to adapt
and
to change. Alignment has been a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be, Steve Denning actually did a good article on this. I disagree with a lot of Steve's stuff, but he's really good in when he criticizes things, all right?
Yeah.
Not so sure about his solutions, but the criticism is good. So he basically pointed out that it used to be that managers wanted long-term employment and stakeholders wanted short-term return.
Yeah.
So then we aligned the two. And now managers want short-term returns. So industry is churning faster.
Yeah.
And you've got greater income inequality, whereas the natural tension between the two requirements produced sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a general manager, because I was a general manager for many years of my life, right? My salespeople had targets which contradicted my production people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had to find a way around it. So, you know, necessary change, necessary diversity is key.
Yeah, and so basically what you're saying is that even if we could align the values, we shouldn't.
Yeah.
Because diversity is actually a good thing.
Got it.
Yeah.
You need it for, and that you can't anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People have this belief that human beings can be reprogrammed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ethically dubious and it's cognitively wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. Values are a consequence of interaction over a long period of time. They can't be top-down programmed by putting things on a card that everybody has to carry around in their top pocket.
Yeah. And one that we already somewhat covered is like ideal states or goal setting. What do you feel about that?
One way of creating perpetual disappointment amongst your employees or your workforce. I mean, what happens when somebody comes in with a change initiative? They say, you know, in 3 years' time at the end of initiative, we'll be this sort of group. And everybody goes, oh, God, my God, here we go again, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the reality is if you manage the present, you have less disappointment in the future.
Yeah. Okay, next, performance targets, setting targets for people.
They're really good if what you're measuring is what you want to achieve.
Yeah.
But the old adage is you get what you measure.
Yeah.
So if the measurement isn't what you want to achieve, it's a proxy measure, it produces the wrong impact.
Yeah.
So, for example, a meta-study on this was reported by New Scientist not so long ago. When people are working for explicit targets, it destroys intrinsic motivation.
Yeah.
So all the evidence supports that.
Yeah. Right?
So the danger is with outcome-based targets, it assumes that you can define a future state, which if it's complex, you can't.
Mm.
And then what happens is people seek the targets regardless of the consequence.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So we work on what are called vector-based targets. So that's measuring direction and speed of travel from the present, but not defining a future state.
Yeah. I've actually talked about bonuses and performance targets as homeopathy because...
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. The science says...
It has less scientific basis than homeopathy, all right?
Yeah, yeah.
Most of the managers I work for, basically kind of like work the targets out at the end of the year. It's a conversation.
Yeah.
And I mean, once I remember the company insisted I was given a target.
Mm-hmm.
And my manager had a sense of humor, basically gave me $3,000 for every general manager I offended and $5,000 for any vice president I offended, provided they complained in writing and demanded I was fired. And HR had to pass it because it was immeasurable. And I overperformed, right? Yeah, people play games with this stuff. It's nonsense.
Of course. Okay, but you mentioned that instead of outcome-based targets, you should or could have vector-based targets. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, we do it with, so for example, if we work at some of the work we do on health and safety, we're capturing multiple micro-observations from engineers in the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. From that, we can create dispositional maps. This uses SenseMaker, which is a product we created. And then within the dispositional maps, you can say, well, the system currently has a cluster here.
Yeah.
I need it to shift over that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I want this to be 30% less dense by the end of the year and that to be 40% more dense.
Yeah.
Now that's called a vector measure.
Yeah.
So the only way I can change it is to change the observations of multiple engineers over time, which can't be gamed. Mm-hmm. So I've got to either change the rules or change the way I respond to people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're doing the same in hospitals.
Yeah.
So we can gather continuous patient records of their experience. So instead of targets like everybody should be seen within 4 hours, which produces unintended consequences, I can say, well, the current dispositions of patient stories is like this, make it like that.
Yeah.
Which means nurses, for example, can do experimental things, some of which work or don't work.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, if the patients feel better, it's going to come out in the measurement system, but it can't be gamed.
And so the point is that we talk once again about like more stories like this, fewer stories
like that,
this.
Yes. Which is a whole new theory of change.
Yeah.
And it's something which can engage people at all levels.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, some of the work we've done on counter-narco work, for example, once we got the stories, you can go to a community worker in the slum area and say, what can you do tomorrow to create more like this and fewer like that? Whereas if you say, how will you create a culture of legality? They don't understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you make them a target for the narcos anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So more stories like this, more observations like that, fewer like this, allows engagement at all levels.
Yeah.
And actually, because it's descriptive, not evaluative, allows far more options to be explored because it makes fewer presumptions.
Okay. Okay.
Which, interesting, is some of the stuff we're doing on user requirements. Yeah, once you've gathered stories of people's frustrations about technology, you can say, what could we do to improve these stories?
Yeah.
And that's a radical change from sending out a systems analyst to interview people.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, yeah. We might want to talk a little more about that. But going through more items on the list, what are your thoughts on Myers-Briggs?
Well, we actually scientifically proved that astrology was more accurate in predicting team behavior. Yeah.
Can you explain? How did you prove that?
Well, we did a controlled test. So we had people did Myers-Briggs and then we created a questionnaire. I had a lot of fun with this over 6 months, all right? It was a 12-page questionnaire in which there were only three relevant things. When were you born, what time and where?
Yeah, yeah.
Then we got an astrologer to cast the horoscopes for all of the members of the control and experimental groups. And that included how they would work together. But if you don't know it, Aries worked really well with Virgos, but not with Taurians, right? And then we got a couple of naive MBA students to rewrite the horoscopes in management jargon.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, we asked each of the teams to say which of the psychometric frameworks had proved more accurate.
Yeah.
And we expected astrology to do quite well, but not to actually get 60% of the score, all right? Myers-Briggs was way down. And I remember saying at the time, that, you know, the reason this works is that astrology has had centuries of working out how to say things with the right level of ambiguity, so you fill in the gaps for yourself. Myers-Briggs has very little valid research base. I mean, it was a couple of people who read a book about Jung, which Jung himself said they didn't understand. And then they created a consultancy method, which became the norm. And the danger with it is it puts people into little boxes.
Next on the list, 360 feedback.
Well, kind of if you haven't learned how to game it yet, all right, you probably haven't survived in a corporation. I mean, you get this big annual event, all right, so you have to nominate these people who evaluate you, which is dubious whether that should happen anyway. I mean, ethically, I've got power over these people. Why should they evaluate me? And you all learn to, you know, well, I'll evaluate you if you'll evaluate me and you know, you play the game, right? So we have a different approach.
Yeah, what's that?
We get any leader can nominate any number of people. Those people tell stories about their experience. They're not asked to evaluate the leader. just tell a story about any time the leader does something, tell a story about it. Mm-hmm. No evaluation. They then interpret it onto a series of triangles. The triangles have all positive qualities.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the leader's behavior was analytical, assertive, altruistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're descriptive, non-evaluative. So they basically place a dot on six triangles around the story. Then the leader can see the pattern, and they can see everything they've got is analytical, not altruistic.
Yeah.
So they can click on it and say, what will I do to create more like this and fewer like that? So you've got a continuous real-time narrative feedback, which is descriptive, not evaluative.
Mm-hmm.
And you get rid of that annual trauma. I mean, all these bloody psychologists, HR departments, you know, it's like counselors. Right, whatever's trendy they go for. I mean, they were all into sexual abuse and then they were into... Just don't, all right? There aren't enough good psychologists in the world to map 360.
Yeah.
But a continuous narrative feedback from a group of employees allows you to modify your behavior in real time.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, when we just launched this, we just put it together,
mm-hmm.
we've now found that individuals want to buy it.
Yeah.
Independently of 360.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're just going to nominate friends or people they work with. And that actually opens up the coaching market. So that's actually quite interesting. But it's a complexity principle is small, fragmented, non-evaluative descriptions in real time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. Do you actually do that? Like, how often do you do that? Because like 360 is in many companies.
You run it continuously.
Yeah. Continuously, yeah. Yeah.
So it's a fee. So it's a. We just set up a joint venture company where it's called 360 Net Impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, and we're just doing the beta tests on it at the moment.
Yeah.
But the principle is non-evaluative, descriptive, voluntary patterns, modify patterns. But if you say to a leader, "How will you create more stories like this and fewer stories like that?" They can work out what to do.
Yeah.
The minute you use the jargon of corporate psychology, it just gets traumatic.
Yeah. Okay, so what are your thoughts on the way that companies do strategy?
It's good and bad. I mean, it's a game.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in corporate strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are says, and let's go back to Kinevin, all right? So mm-hmm. you can run 2 or 3 year plans for the stuff which is obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
You can run limited plans for maybe 1 year or 18 months for stuff which is complicated.
Yeah.
The minute you move into the complex space, you're doing parallel safe to failed experiments. So, for example, we've done work like this, like pull 300 employees together for 2 days
mm-hmm.
and end up with something like 1,000 small safe to failed experiments, which run over the next 3 months. And then we write the strategy document up after we've determined the actions. Yes, to make people happy. So you've got, instead of having strategy, operations, communication, you've got a real-time feedback.
Mm, so it's kind of like a bottom-up approach.
Yeah, but it's combined with top-down. I mean, again, a lot of people are making this mistake. They're saying complexity is an excuse for anarchy,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't. I mean, anarchy just creates a space of fascism.
Yeah.
So it's a constraint-based approach. So you do 2 or 3 or 5 year plans for the ordered domains, but you don't do it for the complex ones. So if you're looking at something huge like transport infrastructure, where we're currently starting to run projects, you certainly you need to create a dispositional map of how people see transport. Then you'll see stable elements. For that, you can build infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they're stable. For the other areas, you've got to have more flexible infrastructure and you've got to play around. And the same, by the way, this is a whole new approach we're working on for software architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because everybody at the moment is arguing that TOGAF is too structured.
Mm-hmm.
And then they produce charts which look just like TOGAF, but they say they're different, right?
Yeah.
We're using narrative-based maps as an alternative architectural approach. Only when they stabilize do you do the classic diagrams.
Okay. Next on the list, what are your thoughts on budgeting?
I think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. The danger is, and this is, I mean, I'm having some discussions with the Beyond Budgeting guys on this.
Yep.
I think they got the instinct right that you get abnormal behavior. So, I mean, we're producing a whole bunch of stuff at the moment because people have got end of year money to spend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things we're saying is if you're in the ordered domains, you can actually have an aggregative approach to budgeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you aggregate the thing up.
Yep.
In a complex domain cannot be aggregated or can't be reduced.
Yeah.
So what you now have is larger budgets that get dynamically reallocated based on proven need.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, a big software project, for example.
Yep.
Yeah, the sort of user requirements clustering together with pair programmers is a budget which gets dynamically reallocated in small numbers, yeah, rather than a sort of predetermined long-term plan. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the secret is, in the complex domain, is bigger budgets,
yeah,
with more dynamic reallocation and change. In the complicated domain, more traditional reductionist aggregative approaches.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the things that that's also a big thing with budgeting and the way that it's traditionally done is that all the theater that's around it. I mean, the
yeah,
way
it consumes a huge. And I mean, the other problem you've got, all right, is I mean, as you say, first of all, there's a huge amount of theater.
Yeah.
And now we've got too much transparency, so people don't take risks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it used to be. I mean, when I was first a general manager, I could spend £10,000 and nobody would notice. And this is, yeah, in the 90s, so that was a lot, yeah, of money. And then gradually over time, even though I got more senior, my budgets got less and less because, yeah, everything was planned and controlled.
Yeah.
And it, you've got senior people, they should be allowed to do some things which aren't visible. So too much transparency destroys innovation. Too little transparency, you get corruption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Aristotle's golden mean.
Yeah.
All right, so I think that's one of the other issues on budgeting is what's a discretionary budget for leaders?
Yeah, yeah.
If they haven't got discretionary spending, they won't innovate.
And your point with too much transparency is the fact that some of the experiments that you run, you won't be able to, like,
tell. Nobody will take risk because everybody can see what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you'll play safe.
Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah. How do you feel about sharing best practices within the company or within the industry?
In the obvious domain, fine.
Yeah.
But I've yet to see any successful entrepreneurial company succeed by following industrial best practice.
Yeah.
They succeed by changing the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So best practice is very limited in its applications.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay, that's a really good, good, like, list of management concepts that we kind of bashed most of them.
We bounded them.
yes. Well, that's true. Yeah. So moving on to other topics. Well,
In fact, hogtied a few of them, but sorry, I'll just stop this. The metaphor is going too far.
Yeah.
I'll get into tarring and feathering next, all right? Which is what you do to safe practitioners.
yes. So closing off, what are you currently studying or interested in or looking into?
Oh, several things. I'm an eclectic.
Yeah.
I'm currently looking heavily at assemblage theory from Deleuze.
Okay.
Which has major implications for culture. In fact, we're doing a lot of work on cultural mapping.
Mm-hmm.
So assemblage theory, and I'm looking at Delander's realist account, right? So it basically says as people tell stories, other people tell similar stories.
Mm-hmm.
Then the stories form a cluster of anecdotes which become a myth.
Yeah.
And it exists independently of its creators. So it exerts downward causality.
Yeah.
So that replaces nonsensical ideas like memes,
mm-hmm,
which is the wrong metaphor, right? Linked with that, we're looking at the anthropology of time,
mm-hmm,
which is a fascinating field because people's perception of time influences how they deal with things.
Yeah.
And that's going to inform the next generation of sense maker, which will have time which isn't necessarily physical.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be perceptual. Yeah. The other really interesting thing, which is informing the counter-terrorist work I do, is constructor theory in physics.
Yeah.
So this is the first non-atomistic account of physics. And that actually says, what are the bounds of what's possible within the natural law? Then within those boundaries, what's the lowest energy cost of replication? Now that's given us a really powerful new way of doing corporate strategy and understanding markets. But also it allows us, if you look at, you know, let's take a topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
ISIS has a low energy cost of replication.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda has a high energy cost of replication.
Can you talk more? What do you mean with that?
Well, if you look at the attractor wells, and we do a lot of mapping on this, I mean, ISIS is almost like a retrovirus.
Mm-hmm.
It basically attaches an ideology which isn't understood to negative feelings on young people.
Mm-hmm.
So it can spread very quickly and mutate in its form, and we can see that. You know, you now got 16 or 17-year-olds becoming amateur terrorists, which is far more scary. If you look at Al-Qaeda, it has a deep ideology and requires a firmer commitment. So it's easy to contain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the issue is what will propagate fastest.
Yeah.
So if you've got something which is negative with a low energy cost of replication, you have to increase the energy cost of replication. And you don't do that by hitting it head on, because then it will just scatter more.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do?
You increase its ideological commitment. You create containment fields. You create alternative attractor mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things which has deeply distressed me post-Paris is you've got people who are now saying, oh, religion is the cause of all evil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's nonsensical. I mean, religion is very fundamental to human beings. And now we've got a new religion called being not religious, right?
Yeah,
which is
yeah.
exhibiting all the same intolerance that it complains about, right? Yeah. And, you know, the reality is that you don't get terrorists if you don't get massive inequalities and social deprivation,
yeah.
right? The minute you've created a problem with social deprivation, you've got a hopper and some terrorists will pop out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the issue is to make it more difficult. It's kind of like an event horizon, if you know that
yeah.
physics.
Yeah. yeah.
If you have a very strong event horizon and people get sucked into it in enough numbers that some terrorists will pop out to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's that pre-radicalization stage, which is where I work, where you've got to change things.
Yeah. Okay.
By the time they radicalize, it's too late. You just got to try and contain it.
Yeah. Okay. What's your favorite book? If you had to mention, like, one book, what would that be?
One book?
Okay, a couple of your favorites.
Oh, God. I find that almost impossible.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is a desert island disc question. What book would you take with you? Right? But you're not allowed the Bible and Shakespeare because everybody says that.
yeah. Yeah.
I never thought about it that much. Mm. I don't know. I'd probably take Aquinas' Summa Theological.
Okay.
Because A, it would take me years to read. All right. And B, it's the first attempt to take a rational approach to religion. And I find that really interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, hey, thanks a lot for your time, Dave. This is a lot to think about.
Yeah, pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You just finished an episode of the Boss Level Podcast. The podcast is new and needs more listeners. So if you think it deserves more listeners, share this episode or any of the previous episodes on Facebook, Twitter, or any other social media site. If you think there's a traditional company that needs to hear this kind of stuff, you can fax the URL to their office. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks. Talk to you then. Take care.